Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Good to have you with us. On today's program, we look at recommendations for statewide standards for evaluating Michigan teachers. Just how should the job performance of teachers be measured? Then he calls himself the Shark. We'll meet a West Michigan man who swims across the Great Lakes. He's done all five of them. He's done Lake St. Clair, raising money for charity. But first, Detroit's emergency manager Kevin Orr is looking to hire a group to oversee Detroit's federal grant money. This comes at the same time federal officials are searching for ways to offer more aid to Detroit. Orr visited with Michigan Senator Carl Levin earlier this month and with economists when he went to Washington looking for ideas about which grants programs would be best for the city. Detroit News Washington Bureau Chief David Shepherdson joins me now with more. Welcome back, David.
Thanks for having me.
So why does Kevin Orr want someone from the outside to be the grants overseer, if you will?
Well, it's a big part of the city's budget, and it's also very complex. Last year, the city got about $290 million in 71 different grants. It's everything from community development block grants to Justice Department grants to federal transportation grants for roads. There's all sorts of different grants, and because there's so many, frankly, sometimes the city has lost track of some of the funds, and as they've been auditing these accounts, there's anywhere from 15 to 25% of the money left in some of these accounts. So they want somebody, a group to come in, you know, look at all the grants, make sure the money's being spent properly, that they're meeting all the requirements, and then ideally to apply for more grants that the city could take advantage of.
It is kind of I don't know, from the outside looking at it all, it seems rather stunning that you have, as you mentioned, 15 to 25% of the funds of some grants are unspent. It's amazing to think that grant money is being left on the table when we have a clear idea how desperately in debt the city is.
No, exactly. And, you know, some of these grants, the money has reverted back to the federal government either because it went unspent or because the city did not meet or comply with the requirements of the grants. And it kind of goes along with just sort of the general problems the city has with managing its books. It has, as the IRS said in an audit, a disastrous ancient system for how it processes tax returns that is almost 20 years old. A lot of attention got paid recently when the city had gotten a $1 million check that it hadn't cashed. So the city just has a lot of problems doing the basics of accounting that's necessary to manage a city and a government as large as it has.
What are the chances? I know, as you wrote in your piece, Kevin Orr sat down with Senator Levin and others. What are the chances of getting more federal aid, more federal grants for Detroit?
You know, I think there is a pretty solid chance, and maybe not necessarily more, but the federal government either giving the city more flexibility. Look, the White House has been very cautious about Detroit. They have, you know, made clear that the city will not get a bailout, although they don't even use the word bailout because they don't want to, you know, bring up references to, you know, Ford to New York dropped dead back in the 1970s,
right,
when then President Ford initially refused to bail out the city of New York. But they are, the senior White House officials are very concerned about the city and have had a lot of talks with members of Congress, with Kevin Orr, with the business leaders, and they are willing to look at ways to repurpose or funds or look for other funds to help the city. One example was earlier this year, about $100 million in mortgage relief funds have been transferred to the state for tearing down blighted homes, and about half of that's going to Detroit. So there are ways that the government can help improve city services, but none of those funds are going to get at sort of the root problem in bankruptcy of the long-term debt and the pension liabilities. Those are things the city's going to have to do through bankruptcy. Nobody's coming in with a big pot of money to fix those problems.
But as Senator Levin said, bankruptcy is not a brick wall, so stuff is able to get in and out, and aid could come. And it sounds like what you're saying is let's use it smarter and make sure that the accounting is right and everything is as it ought to be. Do we have any idea who this might be that he wants to bring in?
They wouldn't say it was a possibility. It could be a nonprofit group, somebody who has a lot of skill and has dealt with grants in the past before. So, they haven't said who it is, but somebody who has a lot of proficiency dealing with the grant process, and hopefully somebody who can go out and try to find some more grants for the city, because the city certainly needs more investment just to keep the streetlights on and, get response to police calls and ambulance and so on.
And it certainly sounds like more proficiency is very much needed, so it would be a chance for outsiders with this expertise and proficiency to come in and kind of get the course straightened, looking ahead to the brave new future.
Yeah, and you really cannot, I just keep thinking back to like GM when it went through bankruptcy and you had a whole new group of leadership come in, and they really asked all these questions on why have you been doing things the way you are. And even GM, which was not a badly run company, but had been doing things for decades, and in any organization, when you all the leadership has come from up within the company, you stop sort of questioning why you do certain things. And that's really the same with the city. And now when you have these, when you think about how important grants are to the city, it's such a big chunk of money, and it does provide so much key services in so many areas. It's got to be a very top priority to make sure you've got the best possible people in there making sure that these things are done right.
David Shepherdson is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. David, always good to talk with you.
Hey, I appreciate it.
We turn now to the complicated questions surrounding teacher evaluations in Michigan. Should there be a state standard for evaluating teachers? What should that evaluation encompass? Should teacher pay be pegged to the evaluation, the pay-for-performance system? The Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness spent nearly 2 years and $6 million on a pilot program in 13 districts, and they've now come out with a recommendation for a new statewide teacher evaluation tool. Jake Neer is the Lansing reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He's actually made the trip from Lansing to join us here in the studio. Good to see you in person, Jake.
It's good to see you too, Cindy.
So tell us, right now, what does Michigan require in the way of teacher evaluations?
Well, every school district is required right now to have some sort of teacher evaluation, and there are guidelines basically from the state saying that you have to include certain things on those teacher evaluations. This is much more of the state saying it has to be more uniform. We have to see more of the same thing throughout the state. You can't just, have all these different local districts coming up with something that isn't, as scrutinized, isn't as well established, and doesn't have what supporters of these systems would say are, proven effective models for teacher evaluations.
And who's pressing for change? Is it coming from parents?
I think that this is something that across the board, a lot of people are saying, we want to see more uniformity. I mean, even the teachers unions right now are saying, even though teacher evaluations in the past have been controversial, they're saying, well, we, if we're going to have teacher evaluations, we want to make sure that it's done right. And so you're seeing people on both sides of the aisle, a lot of support for, getting something in place that is effective. And as of right now, everyone's still sorting through this most recent proposal. So you're not getting glowing reviews from the MEA or from teachers or from, a lot of stakeholders at this point, just because there's a lot to digest. But, it seems like at the very least, people are saying we want something that is going to work across the board.
Okay. So what about pay? How is that going to be tied in?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, it seems like in the past, teacher evaluations have been somewhat controversial. But here, if there is going to be a big battle, in my mind, it's going to be if the conversation shifts to merit pay, which, of course, is making sure that teachers have a salary that is on par with how students are performing and how they're performing in the classroom as well. So there's a bill already in the House that would tie teachers' performance to student growth in the classroom. And one of the conversations that was being had is, should we really be talking about this before this proposal comes out? Is that putting the cart before the horse? And now that the proposal is out, it says very clearly, merit pay has not been proven to work in the author's, you know, analysis, that the numbers don't add up. And they're basically saying, please do not use this as a model for, you know, for merit pay, because it's not designed to do that. It doesn't rank teachers. It is meant, again, for, you know, improvement. And it's not meant to be a punitive system.
So this recommendation report from the Michigan Council on Educator Effectiveness recommends the state should judge the teacher's performance in terms of classroom performance, in terms of student growth. So if a teacher consistently gets ineffective ratings, what do they recommend?
I believe that after 2 years in a row, teachers that are deemed ineffective, you know, they recommend that the school consider firing that teacher. And I believe that in that middle category there between professional and ineffective, if you're in that category for 3 years in a row, that they recommend that the school district counsel a person out of that profession.
Hmm. And if you get professional ratings, you get a good report card, is there some kind of reward, or what happens for those teachers?
I believe that no matter what, they recommend that some sort of growth be talked about, that, you know, there are still areas almost in any case where a teacher could do better in some way. As far as rewards, I'm not 100% sure if that's built into the system. That might be up to local districts. Mm. But it still seems like, again, no matter what category you fall under, you know, the recommendation is let's keep doing better.
Now, what's next? Will there be public comments invited?
Of course, there's going to be a committee process. This is going to have to be approved by the state legislature. Okay. Once the lawmakers come back from their summer recess, this is going to be one of those major issues that they're going to have to talk about.
Jake Neer, Lansing reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network, trying to walk us through what is a very, very complicated issue in the Michigan Teacher Evaluation Group's report. Thanks so much, Jake.
Thanks, Cindy.
And you're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's continue the conversation, exploring the questions, how should the job performance of Michigan teachers be evaluated? Should there be a statewide common standard used to measure teachers? Those were some of the key questions tackled by the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness. The temporary body recently came out with its recommendations for a new statewide teacher evaluation tool. Joining us now is a member of the Council for Educator Effectiveness. She is the principal at Grand Blanc High School. Jennifer Hammond joins us. And we welcome Robert Stevenson, the principal of Donnelly Elementary School in East Lansing. Robert was also one of the top four finalists for National Teacher of the Year in 2010. Robert, very good to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Jennifer, I want to start with you, as you were on the council that came up with the recommendations for a teacher evaluation tool. What was the thinking as to why new state standards were needed?
I was a classroom teacher back in the 1990s, so go back a few decades. And at that time, while we have wonderful teacher preparation programs in the state of Michigan, there isn't a common standard or expectation for teaching. I think time over time, it was important to define what those expectations are, and so that the entire education community, from K-12 to post-secondary teacher training programs. So I think that was part of the thinking behind this, but also nationwide, there's been a groundswell of interest in this topic, and a few states across the country are a few years ahead of Michigan in terms of also holding educators accountable for student achievement.
So what we've had up until now is just if a district decides to do evaluations, there it is, but you don't have any way of knowing whether, you know, evaluations in South Haven match at all with what's being done in Traverse City?
You are correct. In the past few years, there have been some vendors out in the world that have created some common expectations, but you are correct that most districts chose their own model and had their own expectations for teachers and administrators.
So if the standards that were recommended by the Council for Teacher Effectiveness are adopted, how will things change for the teachers of Michigan?
In our recommendations, there is enough flexibility for local districts to make some of their own decisions. However, the recommendations also provide a framework for having that common understanding and expectation for both professional practice, the practice that happens in the classroom, but also the 50% of the teacher and administrator's evaluation that will apply for student achievement and student learning.
And the panel also recommends a teacher be dismissed, what, after 2 years of ineffective ratings?
Correct. And that was a long debated and discussed topic during our meetings. But if you look at some of the rubrics and expectations that have come out of the pilot in the state of Michigan, if you read through those and you see the ineffective descriptors, you will certainly understand why someone in the classroom that is meeting that on a regular basis should be dismissed.
So as we hear, Robert, that the council recommends that half the teacher's evaluation will be based on classroom practices and the other half on student growth, what are your thoughts as someone who's been a teacher and is now an administrator as you hear these recommendations?
Yeah, first, I wanted to commend the work of the council. one of the things that struck me as I read through the report is how evident the goals were that they had set for themselves. They were really aiming for enhanced instruction, improved student achievement, and supportive learning. And that's inherent throughout the report as you read it. As far as the breakdown of the evaluation, I've worked fairly closely with three of the frameworks that had been piloted, and I love that they were piloted by Michigan districts, which is terrific. But the thing that each of these has is some good research as far as the validity of the observation as a tool. And what I mean by that is they've had good success when you have different observers coming in and observing the same teacher, that you would get a similar evaluation. And for educators, for classroom teachers, there is a peace of mind that comes with that, that this isn't just an arbitrary observational tool. The other thing that I like that the council recommended is that the state is requiring that any observer has to be trained so you can increase the validity, and that the state is even supposed to offer trainings annually, which I think is a marvelous thing.
So it sounds like I'm hearing you say, you know, the playing field is leveled.
Well, let me go further.
Okay.
Because it gets complicated.
Mm-hmm, it does.
It really does. And so when you think about the two sides, and this is true for both the administrators and for the classroom teachers, you're really being assessed or evaluated on practice, which is observable. Hmm. And then you are being assessed on the data piece, which is primarily going to be coming from student achievement scores.
Yes.
And this is where it gets really tricky. The tough part is the development of these assessments that, according to the law, have to be valid, have to be reliable, and the state is being charged, rightly so, with developing assessments that will test core content areas. That's going to be language arts, math, science, and social studies. And then the more difficult part are those non-core subjects and developing assessments that will be valid so we can measure student growth. And that is the trickiest part. And my assumption will be that that's where we're going to have the most pushback and the most debate as a state, as far as what is a valid assessment and does it really measure the impact that a teacher has had on student learning.
Jennifer, as you and the council members worked on this, what kind of conversations were had and how did you tackle this issue that Robert brings up?
I think Robert is talking about the exams that the state is charged with building in high-volume areas common to most schools, like, say, an art class mm-hmm. or a health class or a PE class. In that situation, we talked a lot about would those exams be required or not. And in the end, we decided that those would be made available to local districts, and it would be their choice to use the exams or not. And in the event that they did choose to use, say, an art exam for a basic level of art, that they would provide the state with data to then determine exactly what Robert is saying. Is it a valid test? And so the more data they get back, then they are able to improve that particular exam. So certainly the core subject areas, the English, math, science, social studies, and so forth, those are required of all of us. But the secondary type of test would be optional.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Hammond, who's the principal at Grand Blanc High School, and she was a member of the Council for Educator Effectiveness, which recently came out with recommendations for a new statewide teacher evaluation tool. And we're also joined by Robert Stevenson, who's the principal of Donnelly Elementary. And one of the issues that always comes up as we have conversations about teacher evaluations based on student performance, and I know you touched on this, Robert, and I want to go into it more with you, is this idea that teachers only have so much time with a student every day, and they can only be so effective in a student's performance. And you've got the home life, you have parents, you have how much they are or not pushed to do homework and how much school is supported at home. All of those factors beyond a teacher's control. Is it fair that that should bring down a teacher's effectiveness rating?
Here again, the council had tried to be cognizant of those things because obviously we know with any given student who comes through the door, 50% of the learning is out of our control. We know that. Mm-hmm. So we try to control what we can control. Now, as far as the assessment piece, and you'll hear a great deal about this, and this is going to be what's referred to as the value-added model. By and large, what this refers to is when we look at assessments that are collected, state assessments that we use, it's a statistic that is run to try to control those variables that you're referring to, the home life, et cetera, to try to isolate what is the true statistical impact of the instruction aside from those other variables. And theoretically, that is absolutely the way to try to accomplish that. The tricky part is researchers will go back and forth and pick sides on whether value-added models really work or not. But it will be interesting to see where the state lands on the value-added model thoughts.
And what are your thoughts, Jennifer?
A few things. First of all, we took it very seriously and actually talked to some national experts on the topic. But some of the things that I think are important to note in terms of our recommendations is we felt as though the value-added, while being important, should not encompass 50% of any teacher's evaluation. So in any teacher's or administrator's evaluation, it should be only a quarter of their overall evaluation. And secondly, you're also correct, Robert, in that if you don't account for certain factors that in a value-added model, then there are some teachers that will never be proficient or have the highest mark. So you must take into account poverty. And the other piece of it that most value-added vendors will suggest is in order to be included in a value-added measure for a teacher, the student must be present for 90% of the time in school. And when you say that to a teacher or a principal, that makes a lot of sense.
What have you both heard? I'll start with you because you're on the council, Jennifer. What have you been hearing from teachers since the reports have come out about the recommendations?
I haven't. It's summertime, so
that's
I haven't
true.
Had much reaction. So everything so far has been fairly quiet. One thing that I did hear from teachers that they liked was that the council, instead of recommending four summative categories, highly effective down to ineffective, the council recommended three. And for most teachers, believe it or not, the highly effective category has caused the most angst.
Why?
Why? Because we all come to work and to school wanting to be the very best that we can. And this is a new culture that we're building in our schools. Mm-hmm. And so when someone's come to work for 20 years and everything has been acceptable up to this point, and then now we have this new system and saying, well, you're not highly effective, you're just effective, that's a tough pill to swallow. And so the council talked long and hard about recommending these three because this system is about growth, regardless of whether you are proficient, is the term that we recommend, or effective or highly effective. Everyone has room for growth.
Your thoughts, Robert?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. As I understood, it was professional, provisional, and ineffective as the three ratings. And as a new building administrator, fresh from the classroom, one of the things that struck me was the highly effective, effective divisiveness that actually resulted among staff members statewide. It was quite unsettling. But at the same time, there's something that is implied by telling someone they're highly effective. It almost sounds as though you've made it. You've achieved. There's nothing more for you to do. Whereas Dr. Hammond's comment that if we're truly about growth and professional learning, we should call it something else because we want to send a message that educators never stop learning. And we get better and better through professional growth, through collaboration, through constructive criticism and appropriate feedback. And using that highly effective rating sort of pigeonholed some people, I think, into believing that they had finally ascended to that highest level of success. The other thing that I like about the three ratings is the direct connection to certification. Dr. Hammond didn't reference this, but it's highly referenced in the report, and I love it. As it is now, teachers get their certification on a provisional status when they're new, and you can apply for renewal of provisional certificates and then eventually attain your professional certificate. And now they've got it linked that you can't get a professional certificate until you've received 3 years of a professional rating on your evaluation, which to me makes a lot of sense.
We know that the council was very clear that these evaluations shouldn't be used to determine merit pay, but there is a bill in the state legislature right now that would do exactly that. Really, to each of you, as educators, what would you each say to lawmakers who support pay for performance? Jennifer?
I know throughout the country this is being debated as well,
yes.
But I believe there's certainly research out there that shows we're not going to do things differently or work harder for a stipend. We as human beings come to our jobs every day and want to do the best that we can. It's not about the money. So I guess, you know, Lansing will make that determination, but I think if you would ask most educators, I think they would agree that a monetary incentive isn't going to change my order of business. I'm going to change because I like to learn and I want to do the best job that I can.
I completely agree with that sentiment. And Dr. Hammond even referenced the research that's out there. In fact, the research cites something completely different, that those areas that have used merit pay tied to evaluation, they're actually finding the reverse effect as far as reducing professional motivation and even quality of performance. And that's troubling. People go into education because we're intrinsically motivated to do so, and we want to help the next generation be the best, most successful group of societal members that we can. You know, you don't really go into education to get rich. That's clearly not the calling.
And I want to just end with getting a sense of what comes next for these, for the recommendations that have been put out now from the Council for Educator Effectiveness. What do we look for now?
Well, the first is the council members are working with a publicity group to do some town hall meetings. So I would encourage everyone to go to the council's website for that schedule. If they'd like any of their questions answered, we would be happy to do that. And then the next step, of course, is the legislature making some determinations on which part of these recommendations they will incorporate into law and into practice. But I think, too, the report also is very clear about taking time to implement the system in the right way. So doing it slowly, but certainly putting the priorities in place so that we can, in the state of Michigan, we can impact student learning and student achievement in the right way.
That was Jennifer Hammond, who's the principal at Grand Blanc High School, who is also a member of the Council for Educator Effectiveness. And she was joined by the principal of Donnelly Elementary School in East Lansing, Robert Stevenson. I know this is the first of many conversations we could have as this unfolds with both of you. And we want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today on Stateside.
It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, life on the road in a tour bus with a newborn. One Michigan band's going to give that a try. That story's in 15 minutes. I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Forget those sharks we've been hearing about off of Cape Cod. We've had a shark of our own swimming in the Great Lakes, and he has just crossed Lake St. Clair, swimming all alone while pulling two inflatable boats carrying a ton of bricks. Jim Dreyer of Grand Rapids calls himself the shark, and when you look back over his extreme endurance feats, you'll agree he has earned the right to call himself just about anything he pleases. Jim has set records swimming across all five of the Great Lakes, distance records, speed records, and all of this from a guy who said he had to overcome a deep-seated fear of water. Jim Dreyer, welcome to Stateside.
Well, hello, Cindy. Happy to be here.
And you've dried off, I take it.
I got most of the water wrung out of my ears now, I think.
You know, a lot of us around the state have followed your swims, and this latest one across Lake St. Clair to benefit Habitat for Humanity got a lot of attention. And I would figure that the swimming part is challenging enough, but why pull a ton of bricks?
Yeah, that adds to the challenge a little bit. But, you know, the bricks were very symbolic. I've partnered with Habitat for Humanity of Michigan. And, of course, bricks are very symbolic of building. And what we're going to do is we're going to sell those bricks to help fund building projects all across the state. But not only is this a fundraiser, I thought the bricks were very symbolic. You know, there's a lot of people in the state of Michigan who are trying to keep their heads above water right now financially. And what Habitat for Humanity and myself, what we would like to demonstrate is we don't have to sink with the weight of our burdens. And if one man can pull a ton of bricks 22 miles, what can we accomplish if we all pull together? You know, I believe we would have the strength to pull ourselves out of this.
And you did have to dig in and find a lot of strength. You had some tough moments in that last swim, didn't you?
I did. You know, I estimated that this was going to take 30 hours, but nobody has ever done something like this. So, you know, you don't have the luxury of checking an instruction book out of the library on how to do this. You have to write the book as you go along. So that was just an estimate. But when you're swimming into 3 to 4 foot breakers, which is what was happening for most of the swim, it really slows you down, and it added an extra 21 hours to the swim. So it ended up being 51 hours. And what I tell people, it's kind of like if you started pushing a car across the parking lot. It's really hard to get moving, but once you get it moving, you know, it's a little bit easier. When you're swimming into waves, it's kind of like pushing that car across the parking lot with a speed bump every 3 feet.
Whoa. You know, I have to wonder, Jim Dreyer, what happened to turn a kid with this fear of water into a guy who swims across the Great Lakes?
Yeah, you know, it does seem strange. I mean, the pendulum has really swung from one direction to the other. When I was 32 years old, I decided to address my biggest fear in life, which was the open water. You know, I nearly drowned when I was a kid. My sister found me floating face down in the water at our family's cottage, pulled me out, saved my life. I try to remember to give her a birthday card on her birthday every year. And the open water was my biggest fear. And so, you know, to face my biggest fear, finally at age 32, I thought every other obstacle I face in life is going to seem that much smaller. And that really proved to be true. But, you know, what I like to tell people is, you know, what happened with me is I discovered once I faced my fear that I had this talent. I had this ability to swim and just not tire and just go and go and go. And sometimes if we don't face our fears, we miss out on a lot of life. We might miss out on a skill or a talent we never would ever know that we had we not faced our fear.
Of the five Great Lakes, which one gave you the toughest challenge, the hardest time?
The most difficult crossing of the five Great Lakes by far was Lake Superior. I attempted to get across that lake from 2001 to 2005, finally made it on my sixth attempt. And in the first five attempts, even though I fell short of my goal of getting all the way across the lake, I actually set three records in the attempt, which shows you kind of the scope of the quest. But in those first five attempts, I had a support boat. And, you know, when you're out there and you run into storms and you nearly get shipwrecked, which happened a few times to us, I'm responsible for those 8 to 10 lives on the boat. And I don't take that lightly. And plus, they're going to pull me from the water much quicker when we get into those situations. Finally, I decided, you know, Jim, I think the only way you're going to make this is to do this alone. So the event was called Solo Superior. I know anybody who didn't think I was crazy before, they thought it now. Because I took 250 pounds of my supplies, I put it in a dinghy, attached it to my waist, and with a GPS had to navigate and find my way alone 60 miles across Lake Superior to Canada. And it worked.
You did it. Well, I have got to be honest, you know, to someone who cannot imagine even running a mile or two, the idea that, for instance, you ran 26.2 miles in beach sand, then you biked 130 miles, then you swam 55.9 miles to nearly cross Lake Ontario twice. Where does that come from inside?
Well, I really didn't have much else to do that day. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know how that's – I'm not sure if I can easily answer that. It's – you know, we're all wired differently, and, you know, I'm driven to do these types of things, and I train, you know, really hard. I do my homework. I do my research. To somebody from the outside looking in, you know, there may be those that look at this and say it seems reckless, but, you know, believe me, there's a lot of training, a lot of homework and research that goes into it, and you dot your I's and you cross your T's on safety. But you also know the risk coming in, and you have to be willing to take those risks. I guess I'm kind of an adrenaline junkie, but more than anything, I want to make a difference in the world. And for years, I swam for the Big Brothers Big Sisters program, just a great organization. And now I'm swimming for Habitat for Humanity, and a tremendous organization. And you know, I'm a man of Christian faith, and they're a Christian organization. It's just a really, really good fit. And with the economy the way it is today, especially in the state of Michigan, especially in the state of Detroit, where I finished this swim across Lake St. Clair, to help rebuild Michigan through affordable housing is huge, and that's what Habitat for Humanity is all about. And that's really what keeps me going in my darkest hours and what really motivates me the most.
Now, you are about to mark a pretty major birthday. You're going to celebrate the Big 5-0. Apart from doing that, what's your next challenge?
Yeah, whatever my next challenge will be, I'll have to do it as a 50-year-old. So
yeah.
I kind of wanted to get this last swim under my belt while I was still 49, which I just got under the wire. Yeah, age is just a number, people. It really is. It really, really is. So I'm, you know, I joke about it, but I'm really not that concerned. I've kind of coined the term strength swimming to what I'm doing now with this swim, you know, pulling the bricks. And, you know, it combines a feat of strength with swimming marathon distances or ultra-marathon distances, which is something that's new, never been done. I like it. I like the niche. It's something that I'm qualified to do. I think I proved that I'm pretty good at it. And Habitat for Humanity is really benefiting from this right now, so I want to keep continuing that. And I've got some ideas for my next swim, but what was really important is to get that first one under my belt because I knew there would be a lot to learn, and there was. And I'm going to take what I learned and really start targeting exactly what that next event's going to be. But it will be for Habitat for Humanity, and there will be another event for sure.
Might it be outside the Great Lakes now that you've conquered the Great Lakes and Lake St. Clair?
It's possible, certainly. You know, Habitat for Humanity is a worldwide organization. And, of course, you know, anybody, any organization, any Habitat organization can benefit regardless of where I swim. But it may make sense, certainly at some point, to take the show on the road a little bit.
Well, there has to be a part of you, because it's such a famous swim, that says, you know what, I want to do the English Channel.
Well, yeah, I could, and I may. There's a lot of red tape involved with, you know, working with Great Britain and France and some of the swimming organizations over there. But certainly it is a doable thing. This last swim that I just did was a mile further than crossing the English Channel. So in some regards, you know, I haven't physically done that stretch of water, but, you know, I've done the distance, and, you know, my first swim across Lake Michigan in 1998 was three times further than the English Channel.
Yeah.
Now, granted, I wasn't pulling a ton of bricks back then, but.
And salt water, would that be different for you than the fresh water of the Great Lakes?
Yeah, there's pros and cons comparing salt water and fresh water. Salt water, you are more buoyant. You're going to be higher in the water. You're going to swim faster. Salt water feels 5 degrees warmer than fresh water at the same temperature. Depending on the body of water, currents are different everywhere. Mm. Currents are very unpredictable on the Great Lakes. Currents are, well, in the English Channel, it's really tides, not currents. So they're very predictable. At the same time, they're very significant. But the one drawback to salt water is, of course, there are things out there who can eat you. So
this is true. You don't have that when you're swimming in Lake Superior.
True. You know, I think the worst thing that can happen in the Great Lakes as far as sea life is you might, you know, come out covered with zebra mussels like a coat of armor or have an eel attached to the side of you or something like that.
Plus the taste. Not a great taste when you're in that salt water.
Yeah, you raise another point, and that is another that's an advantage of fresh water is you don't get sick ingesting it as quickly. So pros and cons, definitely.
Well, it's been a lot of fun watching you, and you'll have to make sure you keep us posted when you put your next adventure together.
Oh, I most certainly will. Thank you so much for having me, Cindy.
Jim the Shark Dryer, ultra marathon swimmer, who spoke to us today from Grand Rapids. Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. They're called the Ragbirds, a five-piece folk rock fusion band out of Ann Arbor. The band has quite an avid following, fans who are looking forward to seeing the Ragbirds hit the road. But when that happens this fall, the Ragbirds are going to pack more than guitars and fiddles and percussion. They are going to be packing diapers and all the myriad supplies that you need to travel with a baby. Lead vocalist and Celtic fiddler Erin Zindel is due just about any moment now, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
I have to love the name of this tour, the Brave New Baby Tour.
Thanks.
When are you due?
I am due on August 20th.
So the clock is ticking, and when are you supposed to hit the road?
Well, the first show that we have scheduled is at the end of September. I think it's the 27th.
So the baby would be about 4 or 5 weeks old, depending on when baby chooses to arrive.
Right.
And was there any thought of maybe not going out on the road with a newborn, or did you just decide, hey, this is what mom and dad do, and come along for the ride?
You know, of course we thought about it from all different angles and considered all different possibilities, but this is what we do. My husband's also in the band with me and my brother, and we have a friend who's willing to come along as a road nanny, and so she's going to be helping to take care of the baby while we're on stage. And really, I mean, many women go back to work after having their baby, you know, within 4 or 6 weeks sometimes. And, you know, for me, my going back to work doesn't involve me being away from the baby for 8 hours. It's just really the baby can be with me most of the time except when I'm on stage. So I don't know. We think it's going to, of course, it's a brand new adventure for us. So we'll see how it all goes.
And you won't mind being awakened at 2 or 4 or whatever time the baby's feeding schedule falls in and summons you?
Well, you know, lack of sleep is one of those hazards of the road anyways. So.
True. And how do you plan to balance your family time with band time, especially with you're all going to be on that bus together? How do you plan to find that special time?
Well, first of all, we're going to be touring in much shorter bursts than in the past. We used to travel for 2 weeks up to like 2 months at a time. Mm-hmm. And now we're going out just for a few days at a time and just trying it out, making sure it's healthy for everybody, including us, you know, our marriage and the baby and my bandmates and everybody involved. So
what do you expect to hear from your fans as far as this new change and this new addition to your life?
Well, we've already gotten so much love and encouragement and support from our fans and our friends and we meet so many beautiful people as we travel around, and we do play a lot more sort of family-friendly environments and venues, so I think it'll be a good fit. I think everybody's just excited to meet the baby.
Now, you have actually turned to your fans on Kickstarter to help the Ragbirds buy, you want an eco-friendly and a baby-friendly tour bus?
Yes.
How's that going?
It's going well. We have about 5 days left in our Kickstarter campaign. And so we are looking to get a diesel vehicle that's can accommodate the extra people, the extra road nanny and the baby. And that has some you know, family privacy, something like an RV or a bus that maybe is converted to be set up with a bedroom in the back or something. But very important to us is having an environmentally friendly vehicle. We've been traveling for the past 5 years in a van that runs on waste vegetable oil. So we're able to travel in a much more environmentally sustainable way. And we want to continue to do that. That's why it has to be diesel so that we can convert it.
And keep that footprint very, very light, that
yes.
carbon footprint. Have you got any songs percolating in your mind about this whole adventure of becoming a mom?
Yeah. You know, as a songwriter, everything that happens in my life comes out in song in one way or another. And I'm working on writing new songs lately and developing new songs for a new album, which we hope to record next year anyways. But, of course, the themes are tending towards, you know, what's going on with this new adventure, this whole new world that's opening up and all these new experiences.
Well, lots of fun ahead. Aaron Zindel's band, The Ragbirds, getting ready to head out on the road and embark on a fall tour about a month after Aaron and her husband and fellow bandmate Randall Moore will welcome a new baby. Do we know, boy or girl?
We don't know.
Oh, so everybody will be finding out.
Yes.
You can learn more about all of this at their website, theragbirds.com. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Invite you to reach out and connect with us. It's very easy. You can find us online, of course, at michiganradio.org. Click on the Stateside link. We're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we are on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Hope that pick and makes you as happy as it makes me. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineer today was Bob Skahn. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Katie Suha, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow at 3:00.